Detective Leslie White sped up Doheny Road, his headlights guiding him away from Hollywood and towards the hills. White wiped the sleep from his eyes and stomped his foot on the accelerator, eager to reach the wrought iron gates that read, Greystone. The mansion was perched atop the developing Beverly Hills and was protected by a fence and security guards who took a bit of yelling at before the detective was allowed through. White wound his car up the circular driveway to the mansion of one of the wealthiest men in the world, the home of a family so rich that he had to take a road named after them to get there. White was anxious, yet excited. He knew that more experienced detectives would avoid the Doheny Mansion like the plague this night, but White had been waiting for a case like this. White wanted to make a name for himself. He exited the car into a mob of hushed Beverly Hills police officers, and then was escorted by a gargoyle-like butler into the mansion, where White also recognized the chief of police and district attorney Buron Fitz. The atmosphere was unnerving. Everyone seemed on high alert, yet they were all talking under their breath, and no one seemed to be doing much. White walked down the hand-carved oak staircase and turned right down the marble-tiled hallway, wondering how such an imposing place could possibly be a crime scene, when he saw the first victim lying face down in the hallway in a pool of blood. White stepped around the first man and walked into the guest bedroom, where he saw the second body lying spread-eagle on his back. The right side of his face was a solid mask of blood, but the left half featured an odd display of blood flowing in various directions. The man wore only a green silk nightgown over his underwear and a pair of black satin slippers. It was hard to believe that the bloodied man before him had been on the front page of newspapers around the world the past few years. This man represented power in Los Angeles, the immense opportunities that the Golden State had to offer. His family story screamed, "If I can make it here, so can you." But White knew that it took a lot more than just gumption to achieve this sort of wealth. For that, you had to go around the law, or at least learn how to use the law, which this murdered man's father had done and become incredibly wealthy. He had developed the Midas touch, the New York Times explained of the victim's father. Gold flowed out of the grounds at his command. Leslie White now stood above the bloodied corpse of history in the making. This dead man was the center of American history's greatest scandal. This dead man and his family would be the downfall of a U.S. president. This dead man was Ned Doheny. And against Leslie White's best efforts, the truth of how Ned Doheny came to be lying in a puddle of his own blood would be completely silenced after 3 days of intense international media coverage. But to understand how Ned Doheny came to die, we first need to go back to the Los Angeles of 1892, 1 year before Ned's birth. I'm your host, Elise, and this is Old Blood, the historical true crime podcast. By 1892, a destitute Edward Lawrence Doheny had abandoned the mining towns of the Wild West and settled in Los Angeles. Boosters touted the city as a land of opportunity, a golden wonderland where anyone could be anything. Doheny hoped this was true, for he had a terminally ill daughter and no money with which to send her to the hospital. Against Doheny's best efforts, his daughter died of heart disease in 1892 at the age of 7. And though his marriage was falling apart, Doheny and his wife Carrie conceived one more child, born in 1893, almost a year after their daughter's death. An anxiety-ridden Doheny sat outside a hotel in Los Angeles, 36 years old, and wondering how he could provide for his new son, whom he saw as his second chance, when he noticed a wagon rolling past with a substance in the back that piqued his interest. He asked the man driving the wagon what it was, and he replied, "Brea," the Spanish word for pitch or tar. The wheels spun in Doheny's mind. Los Angeles was run by coal, not oil, in 1893. Yet, according to this man, smaller companies were using this brea, this tar, as an energy source. The worker explained to him that when he mixed the sticky black substance with soil, it turned to oil, to fuel. "My heart beat fast," Doheny said. "I had found gold, and I had found silver, and I had found lead. But this ugly-looking substance was the key to something more valuable than any or all of these metals." He tracked down his business partner, Canfield, and went to the lot the wagon man had described at Colton Street and Glendale Boulevard. And from this vacant lot, Doheny and Canfield established the first oil well in the city of Los Angeles. Doheny started the LA oil boom and began raking in more money than he even knew what to do with. By 1920, he would be worth $100 million. Yet, Doheny made much more of his money from Mexico, where he bribed his way through the government to obtain land in Tampico, a land that several other countries, like Britain and Germany, were also after. His Pan-American Petroleum and Transport Company became one of the world's largest oil companies and included the world's largest producing oil well, Cerro Azul. When the Mexican Revolution began in 1910, Doheny hired a private army to protect his interests there. They criticized him for leeching Mexico of its natural resources and was even rumored to have been behind the assassination of its president. To many, in Mexico and the U.S., Doheny was the prime example of vampiric capitalism. Doheny, once so poor that he could not afford medicine for his dying child, became one of the world's richest and most powerful individuals. But though he could now afford to shower his family with everything they could ever need or dream of, his work made Doheny a largely absent father. Always in Mexico, always away on business. Doheny had fallen in love with a young telephone operator named Estelle. The story goes that he had fallen in love with her voice and then divorced his first wife, Carrie, for her in 1900. This news devastated Carrie, and she killed herself by drinking battery acid, though this was covered up in the papers as an accident. Doheny and Carrie's young son, Ned, witnessed his mother screaming in agony for hours after ingesting the acid, before finally dying. Ned then spent another 10 months in the same home before going to live with Doheny and his new wife, Estelle. Ned and Estelle bonded and formed a close relationship, but it was clear that the child was still troubled. Estelle wrote to Doheny about her new son, telling him something disturbing he had said at dinner one night. "Mama," he said, "we could be awfully happy if we were poor, couldn't we?" "Dear, dear little tot, why?" "Because," a young Ned explained, "Papa wouldn't go away so often." Other reports have Ned giving his governess a hard time, and recollections of Ned as a child are generally that he was spoiled and had a hard time regulating his emotions. But his family nevertheless adored him and thought of him as a sweet boy. He attended private Catholic schools growing up, as his parents were devout Roman Catholics. He spent a year at Stanford University and then graduated from the University of Southern California in 1916 at the age of 23. He then joined the naval militia during World War I, something his father was supportive of as a jingo, as a man who believed in using force to protect American interests. A war dog. So of course his son Ned should also fight for his country. He was released from duty in 1919. Back in 1913, Ned had married Lucy Smith. They had a total of 5 children together. Lucy's father owned a gas station near Chester Place where the Doheneys lived in their Gothic chateau mansion. One of the Doheneys explained that every Doheny male was expected to work as a gas station attendant so that they would learn what it was like to do hard work, Doheny included. And it was at this gas station where Ned met and befriended Theodore Plunkett, though everyone called him by his middle name, Hugh. Hugh, from a humble Kansas family, was a tire changer at the station when its owner's daughter married Ned Doheny. The newlyweds hired Hugh as their chauffeur before both he and Ned fought overseas in World War I. When Ned returned to California, he offered Hugh, essentially a brother to him at this point, a job as his personal secretary. Until Ned's death, he and Hugh were inseparable. In 1926, Doheny gave his son, Ned, and Lucy a belated wedding gift of nearly 13 acres of land in Beverly Hills. During the construction of the estate, named Greystone after the Indiana limestone used to build it, Hugh acted in Ned's place and oversaw the building and other business matters. Hugh became such a trusted member of the family that he often signed checks for hundreds of thousands of dollars in Ned's name. The Doheneys relied heavily on Hugh's loyalty by this point, not that they had much of a choice in the matter, because a scandal had flung Doheny, Ned, and Hugh onto the front pages of papers across the world. Doheny was in contact with an old friend of his from his mining days, Albert Fall. By 1921, President Harding had appointed Fall as the Secretary of the Interior. This worked out well for Doheny, who was eyeing government oil fields in Elk Hills, California, and the Teapot Dome field in Wyoming. Fall arranged for the government to lease the land in Elk Hills to Doheny at low prices, and without any competitive bidding. Doheny would thank Fall with a $100,000 loan. Loan in quotation marks, because it was not really a loan, it was a bribe. And unbeknownst to Doheny, Fall also gave the Teapot Dome oil field to another oil man, Harry Sinclair. Eventually, this all came to light with the help of a little reckless spending, and by 1924, Americans were so outraged at the corruption of their government that the shady business deal morphed into what is now known as the Teapot Dome scandal. Doheny had always played around with the law, however law-abiding and respectable he tried to appear. In his youth, he was convicted of a felony in Northern California. He had been arrested with 2 other jewelry thieves and given 3 charges of receiving stolen property. Hell, bribery was how Doheny got the money he had, and it was how he held on to it. Breaking the law did not faze him too much at this point, but what did bother him was that his beloved son Ned hadn't also been dragged into the scandal. Historians have long wondered at Doheny's motivation for involving Ned in the Teapot Dome scandal. All agree that Doheny loved his son dearly, which led some to speculate that perhaps the $100,000 he gave to Albert Fall truly was just a loan. What's more likely is that Doheny, out of love for his son, wanted to toughen him up and bring him more into the family business. Then, too, who else could he trust more than his own son with $100,000? Later, at the bribery trials, Doheny would explain that the $100,000 was a mere bagatelle. For Doheny, it was like lending a friend a $100 bill. It was nothing to him. Well, it was something for most Americans. $100,000 was a hell of a lot of money back then. In November of 1921, Ned withdrew $100,000 from the bank account he shared with his wife Lucy, and then traveled to Washington, D.C. with bestie Hugh Plunkett. Ned and Hugh met the secretary at the Wardman Park Hotel and handed him the money, safely ensconced in a small black satchel. Fall gave Ned something of an IOU, and in less than a month, Ned's father had deposited $100,000 into his account. After the scandal became public, Edward Doheny, Harry Sinclair, and Albert Fall were charged with conspiracy to defraud the United States. Doheny was acquitted in 1926, but then faced bribery charges. Sinclair eventually served a six-month prison term, not for bribery, but for jury tampering, and Albert Fall became the first man to go to prison for crimes while committed in office. But Doheny had years before his involvement in the Teapot Dome legal drama would end. When Greystone Mansion was finally completed in 1928, Ned, Lucy, and their children moved into the estate, keenly aware that their family troubles were not at an end. But at least they were living in luxury in the meantime. Greystone was designed by the famed architect Gordon Kaufman, the same who designed the Hoover Dam in the LA Times building that stands today and replaced the one blown up in the LA Times bombings of episodes 25 and 26. The mansion had 55 rooms, an 80-foot waterfall, a movie theater, secret passageways, and even a bar room that could be hidden at a moment's notice, because prohibition. Greystone had greenhouses, badminton and tennis courts, stables, a jewelry vault, and a bowling alley that was later used in the filming of Daniel Day-Lewis's There Will Be Blood. You know, the part at the end where he goes nuts. I drink your milkshake! Okay, I won't spoil it for the rest of you if you haven't seen it, which you should because it's a fictionalized story about Edward Doheny. But as with much of Doheny's life, it's hard to separate fact from fiction. With the Doheny's, it seemed like there were three versions of reality. There was the truth, how things actually happened. There were the rumors, the gossip, the legends that had become accepted as fact over the years. And then there was the fiction that Doheny created for himself. Hugh was cracking. He was nervous. Everyone was nervous about the Teapot Dome trials. Doheny knew Ned would stay loyal to his family, but he worried that Ned might accidentally say the wrong thing if called on to testify. And Hugh was nervous that the Doheny's would bail themselves out and make him the fall guy. Eventually, Ned was given immunity for his participation in the Sinclair trial, but this did not include Hugh, the other man who had delivered the black bag full of $100,000 to Albert Fall in D.C. The Doheny's moved into the Greystone Mansion just before Thanksgiving in 1928. By Christmas Eve, Hugh was losing it. Hugh's troubles really began the summer earlier, though, when his long nights working for the Doheny's began to take its toll on his marriage. He and Harriet had been married for 11 years, and the marital problems were sending him into a spiral. When she formally filed for separation in August, Hugh moved into the Stanford Apartments on Cochrane Avenue, about a 20-minute drive through today's LA traffic. In October of 1928, the divorce was finalized, and by Christmas, he was having a meltdown. Dr. Ernest Clyde Fishbaugh was the official Doheny doctor at the time, and was called to the Greystone Mansion on many occasions to tend to Hugh, who, by February 1929, was, quote, completely unhinged, end quote. His mental problems were exacerbated by chronic tooth pain that Fishbaugh couldn't cure him of. According to the LA Times, Numerous operations had been made on his teeth and gums, and he suffered intensely. Within the last month, he had become extremely nervous, and his hands and whole body would shake. He liked to go fishing, but recently he could not get his mind off of his teeth trouble. Eventually, Hugh began taking sleeping pills in order to get enough rest at night, but then he became dependent upon the pills, and this caused him problems too. But what most weighed on Hugh's mind was the impending trial. Men were already facing jail time for the Teapot Dome scandal, and he feared he was next. Of course, the Doheny's managed to get Ned immunity. But as powerful as the family was, Americans were furious at the blatant corruption going on in their government, and they wanted people to pay. Hugh was becoming paranoid that the Doheny's meant to let him hang to save their own hides. Ned was worried about his old friend and desperately wished he would take a vacation and get some rest. But when he mentioned it, Hugh became agitated. Ned and his wife Lucy decided to confront Hugh with the help of Dr. Fishbow. It was a sort of intervention where the three told Hugh of their concerns for him and begged him to get help. They would get him into a good sanitarium where he could get some much-needed rest. Hugh refused, Dr. Fishbow said. He simply sat there, almost shaking at times, hands clenched, jaw set at times. He said he would come out of it all right. I could see it was no use to push him further, and so I left. On February 16th, 1929, Ned and Lucy took a different tactic and went to go visit Hugh at his apartment where he felt more comfortable. Ned was terribly concerned for his friend and accidentally made some impulsive remarks that set Hugh off. The couple then backed down, seeing his agitation, and left. They went about their day and went to go see a movie later that night. They returned to Greystone that evening and were getting ready for bed in their upstairs master suite when they received a call from Hugh, who was at the gates and wanted to come in and talk. Lucy tried to soothe Hugh and tell him that it wasn't a good time, that he should go home for the night. But Hugh was intent on speaking to Ned, and Ned didn't want to turn him away. Hugh used his own keys to let himself into the estate and then walked into the first floor guest bedroom, which was where he usually stayed when he spent the night at Greystone. Ned met Hugh in the guest bedroom, clad in pajamas, and the two lit up some cigarettes and began to talk. And then argue. Yell. All five children were home that night, and Lucy was in the library getting anxious at the voices being raised. Dr. Fishbow was at the Hollywood Playhouse that evening, and it was about 10:30 when he received a phone call there from his maid. The maid said she had gotten a call from Greystone, asking the doctor to head over there immediately. The doctor raced to Beverly Hills and was led inside by a watchman. He entered to find Lucy standing on the landing waiting for him. She told him that Ned and Hugh were in the guest room, that she heard arguing, and just as the doctor was coming up the driveway, she heard a loud noise, like a piece of furniture being overturned in the guest room. Lucy and the doctor walked side by side down the marbled entry hall and into the smaller hall of the east wing where the guest bedrooms were. A door separated the two hallways, but it had been left ajar, and Fishbow saw Plunkett walking through the hallway on the other side. "You stay out of here," Ned shouted at them and then closed the door. Then, bang! Dr. Fishbow looked at Lucy. "You go back." After Lucy retreated, the doctor pushed the door to find Hugh lying face down on the hallway floor with a gunshot to the right side of his head. Fishbow stepped around Hugh, looking for Ned. The door to the bedroom was open, and when I looked in, I saw Mr. Doheny lying on his back, a chair overturned between him and the bed. He was dead. They both were. The watchman, Morris, ran to the sound of gunfire and found the doctor standing by the two bodies, and a hysterical Lucy sobbing in the hallway. The doctor asked Morris to take Lucy upstairs to her bedroom. Once she got there, she called her sister Kate and her sister's husband, Anson Lisk, who promised to be there within minutes. Lisk was friends with many in the Beverly Hills Police Department, so he placed a call to them, letting them know what had happened before heading there himself. Ned's father was still asleep at his mansion in Chester Place when Lisk called him. The elderly Doheny raced to the Greystone and walked straight towards the guest bedroom, against the soft objections of everyone there. "I must see Ned," he said. The Emperor of Oil kneeled by his son's body, taking his hand in his. "My boy, my boy," he kept repeating himself. "Yes, it is Ned after all. I had hoped against hope there was some mistake." The oil baron was unsteady on his feet and had to be guided upstairs to see Lucy in the master bedroom. Doheny found his daughter-in-law on the bed, sobbing hysterically. Doheny joined her, and the two mourned together as officials arrived at the home to investigate. When Detective Leslie White arrived, he was directed to the crime scene while the Beverly Hills Police, along with the District Attorney and Chief of Police, began to question everyone at the estate, including maids, butlers, and watchmen. They all told the same story as Dr. Fishbaugh. The newspapers exploded with the news that Doheny Jr. had been murdered, and all reiterated much the same story that Dr. Fishbaugh and the Doheny staff had given. Hugh went mad, killed his best friend, and then turned his gun on himself. "As far as officers can determine," the LA Times explained, "Plunkett probably fired without warning while pacing the floor. Doheny's body, with the hole torn through his head by the death-dealing missile, apparently toppled from the chair to the floor, the chair overturning as he fell." Southern California mourned the death of Ned, who had been quite involved in the community aside from being famous for his name and scandals. While at the University of Southern California, Ned had been a member of the Skull and Dagger Honor Association, and then later became a member of the Trojan Board of Trustees, and so USC decided to cancel classes for the day. Stores across Southern California also closed out of respect for the Dohinis, including the B.H. Dias Company, a sporting goods-turned-department store where Ned had been a director. It all seemed very straightforward. All of the witness testimonies were identical, and there were even witnesses who saw Hugh with the gun in his hand. And behind it all was a grieving father and a wife who simply wanted the publicity to end, so that they could mourn in peace. So the district attorney canceled the inquest and called the case closed, as, quote, "conclusively one of murder and suicide," end quote. That Hugh had gone mad and killed Ned, then himself, was beyond all doubt, per D.A. Buron Fitz. By the time Detective White reported for work on Tuesday morning to continue his investigations, the case had been closed, and he was assigned to a different one. But how could that be, White thought. How could that be when just yesterday D.A. Fitz promised a sweeping investigation? Detective White knew something was amiss from the moment he walked into the guest bedroom at Greystone Mansion. That evening, he immediately set to work analyzing the crime scene. In his own words, "In a luxurious bedroom lay the corpse of Doheny, clad only in his underwear and a silk bathrobe. There was a hole through his skull from ear to ear, and he lay on his back. Blood was crisscrossed in a crazy pattern over his finely chiseled face. Another corpse lay in a doorway less than 12 feet from young Doheny. This was Hugh Plunkett, Doheny's secretary. He lay on his stomach, his face in a pool of blood that welled from a hole in his head. There was a smudge on the ivory-tinted wall where fragments of brain had splattered, and the rug beneath his feet had been shoved sideways as he slumped in death. There was an offness about everything, but the detective couldn't decide what it was until he began investigating. White fingerprinted Ned's body and then moved to Hugh and rolled him over. It was then that White found the murder weapon. It was a .45 caliber Colt revolver, and it was warm. Curiously so for a gun that had supposedly been fired hours earlier. The first thought that popped into his mind that someone had stuck the damn gun in an oven. It was that warm still. He wrapped up the revolver anyway, careful not to wipe away fingerprints or leave any of his own. White then began taking photographs of the room, of Hugh in the hallway, of Ned in the bedroom from various angles, and then he began photographing and collecting the evidence. Near Ned's body, there was an overturned whiskey glass and an unsmoked cigarette lying on the carpet. On the table where Ned had been sitting was an opened bottle of Johnny Walker. He collected the booze, the cups, cigarettes, and other items he believed might hold more clues. The papers would later say that there was no drinking going on at the time of the murder-suicide, but White expected them to say that. It was prohibition, after all. Of course, the alcohol would be swept under the rug, but for the investigation's sake, the whiskey was a clue he couldn't ignore. Hugh and Ned had been drinking together just before the shootings. Detective White was filled in on the household's testimonies and given Dr. Fishbaugh's version of events. And even then, even so soon into the investigation, White suspected foul play, because what he had observed before being given the official Doheny version of events was a mass of contradictions. Dr. Fishbaugh claimed that he and Lucy had walked down the hallway to the guest bedroom, then saw Hugh, who yelled at them, then closed the hallway door and shot himself. But when Detective White turned over Hugh's body and found the revolver, he also found something else. Something, to him at least, that said foul play. In the dead man's hand was a cigarette, half-smoked until it burnt out and singed Hugh's fingers. Hugh was smoking a cigarette when he shot himself? And if he had a cigarette between his fingers when he died, then how could he also have been waving around the revolver with one hand and closing the hallway door with the other? Did Hugh have a third arm that the detective didn't know about? White questioned Dr. Fishbaugh about this, and he changed his story. Oh, Hugh hadn't closed the door, he slammed it. White thought about this. Okay, sure, but how likely is it that someone would choose to shoot themselves while they walked down a hallway with a just-lit cigarette? It wasn't the first time that Dr. Fishbaugh changed his story either. He originally told everyone that he found both men dead and then left the room without touching anything in it. When D.A. Buron Fitz questioned the witnesses again, White took the opportunity to clarify a few things with the doctor, like how Ned came to have such a crazy pattern of blood all over his face if he hadn't been moved. Doctor, you were in the house at the time the shooting took place, and you rushed into the bedroom within a matter of seconds thereafter. Is that correct? The doctor nodded, and White asked again to be sure that Ned was dead when the doctor walked in there, and that he hadn't touched the body at all in any way. Again, the doctor nodded. Yes. Then, doctor, White asked, as an experienced physician, will you kindly explain how blood could run up from the ears and cross back and forth over the face of a man who never moved off his back? Oh, well, that's because actually Ned lived for about 20 minutes after being shot, unconscious but breathing. The doctor rolled Ned over onto his back to administer aid, hence the blood that came from different directions. So, why did Dr. Fishbowl lie about it? The doctor lied that Ned was dead when he found him, and he lied about moving the body. And to Detective White, there was something amiss about the rest of the witness testimony, too. It all seemed robotic. Everyone told exactly the same tale. It seemed rehearsed. Which they would have had time to do. The shootings happened at around 11 p.m., 10:50 if we're going to be specific. Dr. Fishbowl got the call at about 10:30 and then drove to the Greystone Mansion. They guessed that the first shot occurred when the doctor was pulling up to the home, and then when he went inside, talked to Lucy, walked down and saw Hugh who yelled at them, and then allegedly shot himself at around 11. So why had it taken them 3 hours to call the police? It was 2 a.m. before Beverly Hills PD got there. Why? While still at the scene, White also looked around for the bullets. He found 2 spent cartridges by Hugh's body, and 1 bullet was still inside Hugh's head. And Ned had 2 holes in his head. The bullet went in and out. Detective White found the bullet on the far wall about 6 feet up near a door jamb. But Ned was seated when Hugh allegedly shot him, so this meant that Hugh had to have been seated also, and shot from the hip. Otherwise, the bullet wouldn't have traveled at an upward trajectory to find its home 6 feet off the ground. And who the hell shoots someone seated with their hands down by their hip and pointed upward at someone's head? Unless Hugh wasn't seated and decided to crouch down in a super awkward position before he shot upward through Ned's head. Not likely. Detective White conducted a few more tests. First, he wondered why the hell the gun was still so hot when he found it that evening. He shot the revolver many times, trying to see if he could heat it up to the temperature he found it underneath Hugh's body, but no matter how many times he fired the gun, he couldn't get it nearly warm enough. And remember, when White found the gun under Hugh, it had been at least 3 hours since the shooting had occurred. There were also no fingerprints on the Colt revolver at all. None. White surmised that the weapon had either been wiped down, or less likely, the gun was so well oiled that no one's prints stuck to it. Even then, there should be some sort of smudges. There wasn't. There was a hell of a lot of evidence that led Detective White to believe that the murder-suicide had not occurred as the Doheny's claimed. But the most damning of them all was the powder burns. Or burn, I should say, because White found gunpowder residue and burns only on Ned, not on Hugh. Ned was shot at very close range, less than 3 inches from his head. But Hugh had no powder marks. Hugh was not shot point blank. He was shot from a distance. So how is it that Hugh shot Ned point blank and in an upward trajectory, then walked into the hallway, cigarette in his left hand and revolver in the other, while he yelled at Lucy and the doc to leave, then somehow slammed the door shut with his foot or hips or something, and then shot himself in the head from a distance? Interesting. Detective White called the chief and told him his findings. The chief then told White to tell D.A. Fitz himself. White told Fitz what he had told the chief. "I don't believe Hugh Plunkett killed Doheny and then committed suicide. At least it could not have happened in the manner described by the witnesses. The physical facts and the testimony of witnesses do not jibe. I understand, too, that some people believe the Doheny family are too influential to tamper with." But this just put the DA on the defensive. "There isn't a man in the United States that's big enough to stop me from conducting a criminal investigation," Fitz said. White told Fitz what he discovered, and the DA then agreed to a sweeping investigation. White was relieved. He wanted to get to the bottom of things, and he was afraid Fitz wouldn't take him seriously. Once, while he was conducting his tests, a sheriff observed and began asking questions. White told him that he didn't think Hugh shot Ned. "Something is warped about this case," he told the deputy. The man smiled at him but declined to help. "Personally, I think you're right about the shooting, but there's no we stuff as far as I'm concerned. Old man Doheny is too big a man for me to monkey with, kid." White was angry, but the sheriff was right. When the papers broke the news, they all cried the Doheny narrative. They explained how Hugh Plunkett, Ned Doheny's secretary, went mad and murdered his friend, then shot himself. How he suffered from toothaches, marital problems, nervous meltdowns, a sleeping pill addiction, and even a scalp infection. According to the Beverly Hills Police Department, "So far, there isn't a thing that has developed that detracts from the conclusions reached at that time. It is a case of murder-suicide. Plunkett killed Doheny and then took his own life." Then, less than 48 hours after the murder, District Attorney Buron Fitz called off the inquest, signed the death certificates, and called it case closed. The Los Angeles Times, friendly to both the Dohenys and D.A. Fitz, printed the official narrative of events for several days until the funerals were concluded, and then went completely silent. Dead, according to Detective White. The closest the LA Times came to admitting there was something off about the Doheny murder was this. What transpired in the bedroom of that long, rambling mansion in its woodland setting, halfway up the side of the Beverly Hills mountainside, may never be known. Both Doheny and Plunkett are dead. What Detective White could not have known at the time was how corrupt D.A. Buron Fitz was, and would be in the coming years. As a Marine in World War I, Fitz sympathized with the two young soldiers. Fitz was a fierce advocate for veterans, just like Doheny Sr., and thus was a friend to the conservative-minded folk who ran the city. He had ties to Harry Chandler of the L.A. Times, to the city's real estate bigwigs, and with the theater moguls. And as he planned to run for governor in the near future, he also needed to keep men like Doheny on his side. Fitz was a reformer, or at least he claimed to be. When he took office, the number of arrests rose sharply, giving everyone the impression that he was cracking down on crime. What he was really doing was cracking down on the powerless, on those without the ability to fight back. In one instance, D.A. Fitz worked with the executives at Paramount Pictures to ensure that an innocent woman was arrested. When Secretary Daisy DeVoe was arrested for allegedly stealing from her employer, Clara Bow, he interrogated her for 27 hours and refused to let her call a lawyer. There were no charges filed against DeVoe, but Fitz jailed her anyway, and also snooped through her safe deposit box without permission or a warrant. When DeVoe filed a suit against Fitz for wrongfully imprisoning her, he arranged for a grand jury to indict her for grand theft. She served a year and a half in prison. Several years later, D.A. Fitz was indicted after taking a bribe to drop a statutory rape charge. He then perjured himself to cover up the bribery charge. And back when Fitz ran again for governor, he tried to silence Pedro Gonzalez, who had the first Spanish radio broadcast in the state, and used it to speak out against discrimination of the Mexican-American community. Fitz eventually had Gonzalez indicted on a trumped-up rape charge. He spent 6 years in prison. And then there was the Love Mart case. In 1930, Detective White, working for D.A. Fitz to end child prostitution, came across a diary that belonged to a madam named Olive Day. Day confessed to gifting underage girls to rich LA folk, along with her boyfriend who used to work for the Pantages Theater. Alexander Pantages, the wealthy owner of said theater, was brought into the trial after a 17-year-old girl accused him of raping her. And Olive Day, madam, confessed that she had something of a contract with John Mills, a real estate man who demanded one young virgin every week. Day and her boyfriend William Jobelson had a hard time getting such women every week and had to resort to kidnapping girls from LA orphanages. Pantages and the other millionaires involved in the Love Mart case were acquitted with the help of Fitz. Fitz decided to drop the statutory rape case against real estate man John Mills. None of the men accused of kidnapping and raping underage girls were sent to prison. And the bribery charge Fitz faced? It was for selling a useless orange grove to John Mills for far more than it was worth. In exchange, Fitz dropped charges against Mills, saying he didn't have enough evidence. You know who was sent to prison? The only person in the Love Mart case to face jail time? Olive Day, who owned the diary that exposed everyone. And then there was the fact that Fitz lived in a luxurious mansion surrounded by orange groves that cost him $250,000. Angelinos wanted to know how it was that Fitz was able to purchase a $250,000 home, when in his 12 years of service to the city, taxpayers had given him only $150,000 at most. So, yeah, D.A. Fitz was a bit crooked. According to the book Hollywood Horrors, he was notorious for dropping cases and making stories go away when they threatened the interests of powerful figures who looked to him for safety. D.A. Fitz was the epitome of corruption in 1930s Los Angeles. Ned Doheny was buried with great fanfare on February 19th, 1929, 3 days after his death. Services were held at St. Vincent Catholic Church, built only several years earlier and paid for by the oil man himself, Edward Doheny. It was known to some as the Church of Holy Oils, and to others as Doheny's Fire Escape. Doheny was a sinner, but a very Catholic one at that, and was once told that because he had more money than others, he had to give more money away than everyone else to get into heaven. Thus, he built the Church of St. Vincent. And his wife Estelle was the greatest contributor to the Catholic Church in Los Angeles. Ned's body was then taken to Forest Lawn Cemetery and interred at the top of a hill that was decorated with a 16th century marble canopy, said to have been a sympathy gift from the Pope. Hugh Plunkett was buried the next day, below Ned and only yards away, paid for by the Dohenys. Hugh's mother wept uncontrollably at her son's grave, while her remaining children attempted to console her. But her kids, too, were mad with grief. Newspapers reported Hugh's little sister Isabel fainting as his body was lowered into the earth. And then Hugh's brother Robert fainted. The papers had also tracked down Hugh's ex-wife Harriet. Some time after her divorce to Hugh, she took off into the San Gabriel Mountains to live in an ashram. And whatever animosity she felt towards Hugh dissipated when she heard of his death. She collapsed with the news and then made plans to attend his funeral. She arrived with two male friends and stood apart from the family, silently. Mama Plunkett didn't want any drama with the Dohenys, and so the family generally stayed quiet. They felt powerless. They felt, as the sheriff warned Detective White, that Doheny was just too big to monkey with. But the Plunketts were angry. They didn't believe a word the Dohenys told them, even before Detective White's findings became known. When Doheny bought Hugh's cemetery plot, he bought some for the entire Plunkett family, but none wanted to be buried there because of what it all symbolized. To them, it was a giant fuck you. According to John Creel, the stepson of Rob who collapsed at Hugh's funeral, quote, "They never truly allowed an investigation, so we'll never know the true story. Everyone was afraid of the Doheny's, so the things published weren't true. The Doheny's were just so powerful." End quote. Rob Plunkett heard of Leslie White's memoir, Me Detective, when he published it in 1936 because he knew that some of it was about his brother's death. But when he tried to get a copy of it, he couldn't find one. The conclusion he came to was that the Doheny's had purchased every damn copy they could get their hands on, so no one would read it. Following the murder-suicide, much was made of Ned's relationship with Hugh. When word got around that things were fishy with the Doheny's, many began to speculate that perhaps the family was covering up for Ned and Hugh because they were homosexual. People spread rumors that Hugh shot Ned during a lover's quarrel. Or perhaps Lucy had walked in on the two in an intimate moment and shot them both. Relatives of them both deny this. Rob Plunkett said the accusation was, quote, "totally unfair," end quote. But as his stepson noted, of course he would say that. Hugh was his brother. But John Creel tended to agree with him, saying, "It was simply Hugh's job to take care of Ned because no one in the family could deal with him." See, the Plunketts knew what the press did not. Hugh wasn't the one with the mental illness. Ned was. In West of Eden, Jean Stein interviewed members of the Doheny and Plunkett families in order to get a sense of what truly happened that fateful night. In it, historian Richard Rayner explained that during the Teapot Dome scandal, Edward Doheny had written to Albert Fall, telling him that his son Ned had just spent the summer at the Mayo Clinic. "You get the sense that everything was proving too much for his son," Rayner explained. Harriet, Hugh's ex-wife, wasn't afraid to speak up. Yeah, Hugh was really stressed about the trial, but not enough to kill himself and his best friend. He was upset, but he wasn't insane. Creel supported this, saying Hugh's brother Rob agreed. According to him, if anyone was disturbed, it was Ned. He was a very unstable person. Ned Doheny was there when his biological mother killed herself. There when she screamed in agony for days before dying. And however doting his father may have been, he was still an absent father for a lot of his childhood, as he was often away in Mexico on business. And then there were the rumors that Ned was, quote, "acting up and kicking his governess black and blue," end quote. And then Ned went into the Navy in World War I. I'm sure he was shielded from a lot as Doheny's son, but that still must not have been great for his mental health. And in West of Eden, Rob Plunkett's stepson dropped one hell of a bombshell when he explained that at Greystone, which the family only moved into 5 months before the shootings, Ned was so unwell that he was separated from his family. "What is never talked about," John Creel explained, "is the fact that Ned lived in a different section of Greystone. The family didn't want his children to see him when he was incapacitated. That's why he lived in a separate part of the mansion." He lived in a virtually separate part of the mansion. Which is why the shooting did not occur in the master bedroom or even one of the main living rooms of the home. The guest room had always been a strange aspect of this case. It's one of the first things I wondered about. Why the guest bedroom? I've seen more than a few writers claim that the room was Hugh's room, but Hugh did not live at the Greystone then. He had his own apartment. Could it be that all along the guest bedroom was Ned Doheny's room? Just the question itself paints a very different picture of the incident. Let's suppose for a moment here. Let's suppose that the Plunkett narrative was the truth, rather than the Doheny version. Hugh wasn't doing great. His wife left him and he was facing possible jail time for being the Doheny bagman. But hey, Hugh knew the dangers of being associated with a family like theirs. He knew what he was getting into. And he also got the perks, so it wasn't too bad. The liberties he had as a Doheny faithful was quite nice, as was the fact that he, a lowly migrant from Kansas, now had money. He was grateful for this income and relied on it to help his family. Hugh was currently paying his brother's way through USC's School of Engineering. Hugh was stressed, but he had responsibilities, like Ned, like ensuring that his boss, his best friend, was all right. Ned had a good heart, but he was a troubled guy, and Hugh needed Ned to be okay. Hugh had known Ned for years, had gone through the hell that was the First World War together, and then spent many years together as Ned's right-hand man. They were everywhere together, they were practically brothers. But with this Teapot Dome scandal, and people with actual money having to do actual jail time, Hugh began to speculate that he was not really considered a member of the family at the end of the day, despite what the Doheny's said. Doheny's got immunity. Hugh did not. Hugh would have to testify, and he feared that with how angry everyone was over the blatant corruption, someone would have to pay. Hugh feared that someone was him. And though his employers swore that Hugh would be taken care of, that they would do everything in their power to protect him as one of their own, Hugh had seen too much of the world to trust the Doheny's completely. They told Hugh that they had a plan to keep him out of the trial. They created an elaborate story wherein Hugh was cracking under pressure and losing his mind. He would eventually become so ill that he needed to be placed in a sanitarium. Once in the sanitarium, Hugh would no longer be called to testify at the trial, and thus would escape prison. But Hugh was no dummy. He had heard the horror stories of families like these sending their enemies to asylums and locking them up for the rest of their lives. Or it would simply be used to discredit everything Hugh had to say. Oh, Hugh? He's crazy. He was just in a sanitarium. If he ever got out, that is. Hugh knew an awful lot about the oil man and his family. What guarantees were there that he would ever be allowed to leave? So, no, Hugh didn't like the idea of going to a sanitarium to get out of the scandal. When Dr. Fishbaugh and Ned confronted Hugh about it, he said he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't go. He was agitated about it all. On that, the doctor was correct. Perhaps he really did sit there, fists clenched and trembling, thinking that his best friend was trying to set him up. And again, when Ned and Lucy visited him in the afternoon of February 16th, they began to argue. The couple was trying to convince Hugh to go to the sanitarium, but he refused. Ned and Lucy left Hugh's apartment, leaving him alone with his thoughts. Hugh didn't like arguing with Ned. Perhaps he didn't like what happened that day, the things that had been said, so he decided to head over to Greystone later that night when Ned would be back from the theater. They would have a drink and talk things through. So he drove up there and used his key to let himself in at around 9:30 p.m. Ned and Hugh poured themselves some Johnny Walker and had a seat in the guest bedroom where Ned was staying given the circumstances of his mental state. Hugh found Ned getting ready for bed when he got there, so he was in his underwear and a nightgown while Hugh still wore his pinstripe suit. The friends began to talk and drink, and then began to argue. About an hour had passed with the two drinking and conversing before things really got heated. Larry and Dickie Dell, the two eldest children of Ned and Lucy, were still awake when their father and uncle began fighting. They stood on the landing of the staircase, trying to hear what was going on. Ned was yelling at Hugh, and Hugh was yelling back. Perhaps Lucy, too, was trying to calm the men down. And at some point, Ned's hands found their way to the Colt revolver. The Colt was a Doheny gun, by the way, kept most of the time in the Greystone safe, as later disclosed by the LA Times. It was a Bisley model single-action revolver that had gone out of production in 1912. It sold well in the American Southwest because this was the type of gun used by Pancho Villa, the widely popular leader of the Mexican Revolution. The Bisley model was a cowboy gun, first made in 1894, perhaps from Doheny's mining days in the Wild West. And in 1929, for reasons lost to us, the obsolete Bisley model Colt revolver had made its way into the hands of Ned Doheny. Ned Doheny, angry and off-kilter, and Hugh couldn't get him to calm down. Hugh lit a cigarette and was walking away from Ned, down the hallway to where the guest bedroom was, also to where there was an exit at the end of the corridor. He had almost reached the bedroom when he heard his name. Hugh. Hugh turned his head to the right to look behind him and found Ned Doheny pointing a revolver at his head. Ned fired into Hugh's right temple. Hugh fell forward, his feet shoving the rug to the side before he landed on his stomach. Blood flowed from his head and pooled onto the hardwood floor around him. Ned stepped around his murdered friend and walked into the bedroom. He sat down on the chair where he and Hugh had just been drinking whiskey. Ned took the revolver in his left hand and held it up to his left temple. When he fired, the bullet traveled through his skull, out the other side, and into the far wall, while his body tumbled to the right and onto the floor, knocking over the chair. When Dr. Fishbaugh entered, he found Ned lying on his side, the right side of his face pressed into a pool of blood. The doctor tried to revive Ned and rolled his body over so that he could check his pulse, at least, and this movement allowed rivulets of blood to flow from his forehead down in various directions across his face. The doctor could do nothing for either men. Both died. All that was left was the cleanup. The wiping of fingerprints, the organization of witness testimonies, the placing of the gun under the other man's body. The son of Edward Doheny could not have committed suicide. At least, no one could know this. It would ruin the family. So a narrative was created where Hugh was the insane one. Where Hugh, in a fit of madness, killed his employer, the poor Ned Doheny. Phone calls were placed to all the appropriate people. Lucy's brother-in-law, Anson Liss, called his friends at the Beverly Hills Police Department. Who knows who Edward Doheny called in the midst of his grief? I am not the only one with the opinion that it was Ned who committed murder and suicide, not Hugh. In the book West of Eden by historian Gene Stein, Lucy Doheny's nephew stated, "Ned committed suicide." He recalled the 2 a.m. phone call placed to his dad, Anson Lisk, of his calling the Beverly Hills PD. "I think Ned shot his male secretary and shot himself," he said. John Creel, the stepson of Hugh's brother, said the same, particularly after finally finding a copy of Detective White's book at the library. "And when you read White's book," Creel said, "there's absolutely no question that Ned Doheny shot Hugh." For most looking into the case, the greatest clue that Ned Doheny was the aggressor and not the victim is Forest Lawn Cemetery. Edward and Estelle Doheny were extremely religious, extremely devoted to the Roman Catholic Church, so much so that Pope Pius XII named Estelle Papal Countess for her contributions to the church and her community. Estelle and Doheny were both buried at the LA Cavalry Cemetery in LA. Ned Doheny, after his service at St. Vincent's Catholic Church, was then taken to and buried at Forest Lawn. a non-denominational, non-Catholic cemetery. Why would Doheny, a devout Catholic, not bury his son in a Catholic churchyard? The obvious answer to this was that he simply couldn't. The Catholic Church viewed suicide as a sin, so those who killed themselves were not allowed to be buried on church grounds. From the very beginning, my family never believed that Hugh killed Ned and committed suicide, Creel explained. And they were very, very upset about that. The whole issue of Hugh not being mentally stable was strictly manufactured so that he wouldn't have to testify. The Plunketts were forced to watch as newspapers across the country slandered their murdered relative, calling him crazy, calling him a murderer. Even in Hugh's eulogy, they wrote of him, "In a moment of fever and excitement, this man was not himself, and his moment came. We leave him in God's keeping." A spokesman for the Dohenys told the press that Hugh, quote, "had been strung out on sleeping pills for several days before the shooting," end quote. They called him highly excited and nervous, very disturbed. When Dr. Fishbaugh was asked about Hugh's behavior and whether or not the doctor thought Hugh might have been trying to escape the home when he was killed, Fishbaugh said, "No, I think he was insane. A fit of insanity seized him." Other headlines screamed, "Doheny's slayer was a madman. Crazed secretary kills millionaire and himself." By comparison, Ned was an angel, a faithful friend who was only trying to help calm the situation. LA Times headlines read, "Doheny lauded for friend aid. New York lawyer asserts he died helping pal. Rich man was attempting to benefit classmate. Ned made a great sacrifice. He gave his life. And Ned Doheny died the finest kind of death. He died trying to help a friend." The evidence left at the Greystone better fit the narrative that Ned was the shooter. But still, there are unanswered questions. Like, what was the true nature of Hugh and Ned's relationship? Was there any truth to the rumors that they were homosexual? And if so, did this play any role in the events of that night? Perhaps Hugh truly was the one person in Ned's life who could help control him, as their relatives later claimed. And if that's true, it makes me wonder if Ned wasn't actually summoned to the Greystone that night. Could it be that controlling Ned was part of Hugh's job as his personal secretary and Doheny confidant? Could it be that Ned started to lose it and someone at the Greystone called Hugh for help? Perhaps Hugh was the great friend who made the ultimate sacrifice. This also opens the question of, who was it that called Dr. Fishbaugh? Because this was one of the details that was only vaguely answered by the press at the time. Some sources say it was Lucy who called. The doctor received a call at the theater from his maid, but there are conflicting stories as to who it was that called his residence. The doctor later told everyone that Ned himself called, said that there was a phone book open on the bed of the guest bedroom, and that it was open to his name. This sounds way too convenient for me in terms of how it made Ned look like the good guy, trying to get help for his friend. But also because why would they need to open a phone book to summon a doctor who was always over at the house helping Hugh? So, who did call the doctor? Was it Hugh himself, seeing Ned become more unhinged than usual? Or was it someone else at the Greystone overhearing the outbursts and becoming concerned? Someone like Lucy? Lucy is the other question mark here, because surely she knew the truth of what happened to her husband. And yet she remained silent about it all. She remarried a year later at the Greystone, and she, her new husband, and the 5 children from her marriage to Ned lived in the mansion until 1955. To what extent was Lucy involved in the events of that night? What did she overhear? What did she see? Estelle Doheny also remained quiet about that night, and what's more, she burned all of Doheny's letters and papers immediately after his death in 1935. Later, she claimed to have regretted doing so, but what exactly was she trying to hide? The interesting thing about this case is that, despite the Doheny's power over Los Angeles during these years, despite all they had done to keep the truth a secret, all those they had bought off and silenced, Angelino still saw through it. The LA Times, even while spouting Doheny rhetoric, still made room to hint that there was more to the story. Detective White tried playing by the rules, tried doing things the LA way, but found corruption around every corner and felt obligated to say something about it. Raymond Chandler, the famous mystery writer, either from knowing Detective White or just reading his memoir, learned of the events at the Greystone and was inspired to write about it. His most well-known work, The Big Sleep, stars the Sternwood family who made their money in the LA oil boom and references these oil derricks throughout. The main character, private investigator Philip Marlowe, is hired by General Sternwood, a stand-in for Edward Doheny, but spends the book fighting off a corrupt Los Angeles police force and politicians. Chandler's 1942 book, The High Window, was unabashedly about the Doheny murder-suicide, and in this book, investigator Marlowe confronted an LAPD detective about a murder-suicide that had clearly been covered up. This is from The High Window. Quote, "I'm going to make a point, and it's an important point. Just look at the Cassidy case. Cassidy was a very rich man, a multimillionaire. He had a grown-up son. One night, the cops were called to his home, and young Cassidy was on his back, on the floor, with blood all over his face, and a bullet hole in the side of his head. His secretary was lying on his back in an adjoining bathroom, with his head against the second bathroom door leading to a hall, and a cigarette burned out between his fingers on his left hand. Just a short, burned-out stub that had scorched the skin between his fingers. A gun was lying by his right hand. He was shot in the head, not a contact wound. A lot of drinking had been done. 4 hours had elapsed since the deaths, and the family doctor had been there for three of them. Now what did you do with the Cassidy case?" The LAPD detective replied to Marlowe, saying, "Murder and suicide during a drinking spree. The secretary went haywire and shot young Cassidy. I read it in the papers or something. Is that what you want me to say?" The detective responded, "You read it in the papers, but it wasn't so. What's more, you knew it wasn't so, and the DA knew it wasn't so, and the DA's investigators were pulled off the case within a matter of hours. There was no inquest, but every crime reporter in town and every cop on every homicide detail knew it was Cassidy that did the shooting, that it was Cassidy that was crazy drunk, that it was the secretary who tried to handle him and couldn't, and at last tried to get away from him but wasn't quick enough." The Doheny cover-up is so widely known now that it has become, as I said, a part of LA lore. It's the lie that keeps being told. Go to the Greystone Mansion today, walk into the guest bedroom where the shootings occurred, and you will find two lovely poster boards. One tells you all about Edward Doheny, and the other is a Did You Know About Ned? No board about Hugh. And both official websites for the Greystone Mansion describe Hugh as the perpetrator of the murder-suicide. My last question of the episode is this. Why are we still lying for the Dohenys? On another note, if I am mysteriously murdered after this episode goes live, the Dohenys did it. It is up to you, my dear fans, to avenge my murder and get me onto a Netflix documentary. No pressure, though. Thanks for listening. I'll be back here in a few short weeks for episode 39. A complete list of our sources can be found in the show notes or on our website at oldbloodpodcast.com. If you're interested in seeing photos and other images related to this case, check out our Instagram by searching for Old Blood Podcast. Music credits to Shane Ivers at silvermansound.com. It's